This is Sam Robson here today with Dr. Kevin DeCock. Today's date is June 8th, 2016, and we're here in the audio recording studio at CDC's Roybal campus in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm interviewing Dr. DeCock as part of our CDC Ebola Responders Oral History Project. So Dr. DeCock, thanks so much for being here. Really happy to see you. And for the record, could you please state your full name and your current position with CDC?
Yes, pleasure to be here. So I'm Kevin DeCock, and I'm the country director for CDC Kenya. That's CDC's office in the Republic of Kenya.
Right, thank you. And can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Belgium, in a town called Aalst, which is between Brussels and Ghent, in 1952.
Okay. And did you grow up in Belgium?
Yes, I did. But at the age of seven, I was sent to boarding school in England. My father was Belgian, my mother was American, so I'm a dual citizen, Belgian-American, and was educated in the United Kingdom in England.
Gotcha. What did your parents do?
My father was a surgeon, a general surgeon of the old school, who did everything except cardiac surgery and neurosurgery, pretty much did everything else. My mother was a home carer.
Right. How did you find school in the UK?
In 1959, going to England from Belgium to boarding school was difficult. Not speaking English initially. England was changing, but it certainly was not as harsh as you read about, you know, 75, 100 years ago. But it was difficult. It was harsh.
Referring to their education system, especially?
The boarding school, cold showers every day, that sort of stuff, discipline, physical punishment.
Oh my goodness!
No, actually, of which I had very little, I must say. But
that's good. And so, what kinds of things were you interested in growing up?
I always, for a very long time, I thought I wanted to study medicine. I think I decided that from a very early age. A few things happened that undoubtedly influenced my future life. One is that my father died when I was quite young. He got sick when I was 11 and stopped working and died two years later, so when I was still 13. For a number of reasons, for some sort of structural organizational reasons and nothing to do with my own intelligence, I ended up being pushed ahead in school, changing schools, being pushed ahead a couple of years. So I actually finished the equivalent of high school when I was 16 and then took a year off. I already had my place at university to study medicine. In the UK, in most of Europe, and in the UK, medicine's an undergraduate degree. So you go straight from school to medical school. So I had a year off. So I was 16 and a half, went to university when I was 17 and a half. And that year off was eye-opening. I traveled around Europe hitchhiking and doing some voluntary work camps in Switzerland, France, Sweden, Holland, and got exposed to a lot of stuff that I really had not thought about that much before, including, for example, why some countries were rich and some were poor. Just thinking, being exposed more to social conditions as well. And it was sort of I was already interested in politics anyway, but it was an awakening in a way that I guess that probably influenced my choice of medical career, because I was then always interested in the problems of the South, and from a very early age said that I would go and work in as we then referred to them, in a developing country at some stage. I'm very glad I stuck with medicine, because this year off had such an influence on me that I thought, I'm not going to do medicine, I'm going to do politics and economics. And I kept sort of switching backwards and forwards and thinking, I thank the Lord that I stuck with medicine. So I'm very grateful for that. But I settled on doing internal medicine, medical school, and then internship were obviously very formative and difficult deciding what to do, but I very glad I settled on internal medicine. and decided, well, once I've done my specialist training, I would go to work in a developing country. But there's an additional reason for doing it, actually, was that in Belgium, there was still a military service, obligatory military service. But if you work in a developing country for 2 years, that counted instead of going into the army. So for me, this was the win-win thing to do, because I wanted to do this anyway, and then it met my military obligation. And I ended up doing my internal medicine training, then deciding at some time, okay, I'm going to do this now or I'll never do it. So I quit, went and enrolled in a tropical medicine course at the University of Liverpool in England, and ended up getting a job as a lecturer at the University of Nairobi, which is kind of like an assistant professor, at the University of Nairobi, working at Kenyatta National Hospital, which is like the Grady of, the Grady is the hospital here in Atlanta, the Grady of Nairobi. And it was just, I went for 2 years, but stayed three, and it was just a remarkable life-changing experience. And I was young. I was, when I went, I was 27. So I came back. I left there when I was 30. And you got to tell me when to stop, by the way, or I'll just talk.
this is actually going really well.
So I had done some work in Nairobi, some research work, a particular a sort of research project on really on the diagnostic approach to certain tropical diseases, and had a lot of biomedical materials, blood specimens and liver biopsies and so on, and went back to England with a research grant to actually write this up like a PhD thesis in medicine, which I did. And then I went to, I had already arranged to do a fellowship. I always thought I wanted to work in the United States for some time at least. And I was oscillating between a career in liver disease or infectious diseases, and settled on doing a fellowship in California, in Los Angeles, at the University of Southern California on the liver unit in hepatology, with a particular interest in infectious aspects, particularly viral hepatitis. I did that. It was a very intense, productive 3 years, actually, working in specialist, as a clinician, but doing research, specialist liver disease. And by coincidence, I had met people from CDC in Kenya, but I didn't really understand what CDC actually did. But I had some very good friends who, in fact, the first director of CDC's work in Kenya, that was back in 1979, I met these folks and became friends with them. And and then again met people in Los Angeles through my boss, Dr. Alan Redeker, who was a hepatitis expert. Met various people from the hepatitis branch here. Jim Maynard was the then director, Hal Margolis his deputy. And long story short, I got interested in coming to CDC. I probably had the opportunity also to go to NIH, but I settled on CDC. And really, again, that was all life-changing, and ended up going into public health, which, while at heart, I still feel very much the clinician, but I haven't done any clinical medicine for quite a while.
Why did you choose CDC over NIH?
For several reasons, actually. Firstly, NIH would have been lab work, which I did not think was my, you know, I guess I could have learned it, but it wasn't really my natural attraction. And there was a funny story about the CDC engagement, because Maynard, head of the hepatitis branch, had talked to my boss about a study that they wanted to do, that Maynard wanted to do in Brazil, in the Amazon. He wanted to get a boat, and he had discussions with the Brazilian Navy. They were going to get a Brazilian Navy boat to sail down the Amazon to do studies in the villages, because a particular tropical infection that's in the, you know, historical tropical medicine books called Labria fever. Always unclear what Labria fever was, and there were suggestions it was probably yellow fever or a variant, or anyway, there was now accumulating evidence that Labria fever, which caused death from liver failure, probably was hepatitis delta virus, HDV. And we had the biggest experience in the United States with this infection in Los Angeles, and it was my particular interest. So Maynard asked Redeker, "Can you, have you got anybody on staff who could do this study with us as a hepatologist?" And Redeker said to me, do you want to do this? I said, going down the Amazon in a boat? Yes. So I thought, I'm not making this up, by the way. I said, if this is the sort of stuff that CDC does, this sounds a lot more interesting than doing, going to the NIH to do lab work. So I applied for EIS, the Epidemic Intelligence Service, and thinking I would be doing hepatitis, but that didn't quite work out.
You never went down the Amazon?
What Maynard told me later was that the Brazilians took the protocol that CDC had developed. They did the study themselves, and CDC wasn't involved. So I never went down the Amazon. But I did come to CDC expecting actually to do viral hepatitis, but there was no opening in the hepatitis branch when I came, and I ended up in viral special pathogens, which brings us to Ebola, because that's the branch that deals with hemorrhagic fever viruses. So anyway, that's a long story of how I got to CDC.
That's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing. So yeah, tell me about some of the work that you did in EIS that was about hemorrhagic fevers or was in West Africa.
Well, actually, it's interesting, and I won't go into the HIV work because I'm talking to your colleague Mary Chamberlain in a couple of days. But this was 1986. Now, if you remember, AIDS was first described in 1981, the virus in 83. Serologic tests only became available in, I think it was 85, commercially, or 86. It just happened that so these were still early days in the AIDS epidemic, and it at CDC, the sort of entry into Africa was actually through my EIS supervisor, Joe McCormick, who had led a very important study in 1983 that. In Kinshasa in late 83 that led to the establishment of Projet Sida in Kinshasa in 1984. So I was very interested in this particular branch because by the time I left Los Angeles, I was already more interested in AIDS than in hepatitis, but interested in all of them. But the fact that special pathogens was actually the conduit to work in Africa on HIV was what really interested me. And I'll talk to your colleague about that. Mm-hmm. So I was broadly interested in a lot of things and very happy to work on hemorrhagic fevers. Now, interestingly, it turned out that in my 2-year EIS experience, which was very good and rich, there were no hemorrhagic fever outbreaks at all. So I never went to the field to study hemorrhagic fevers. I wrote some guidelines. I did get involved in 2 very large outbreaks of yellow fever in Nigeria. And the rest of my work was mainly HIV related in Africa. So coming to Ebola all that time later in 2014 really sort of felt like coming full circle because I never had having done Ebola field work, in 2014, you come to the biggest epidemic ever, and there's a remarkable sort of conclusion of, a lot of years at CDC.
Any particular memories that stand out to you from, I think you mentioned there were 2 big outbreaks of yellow fever in Nigeria?
lots of sort of classic EIS experience, really, of being thrown in the deep end and learning by doing. I had just come back from Zaire, called the Democratic Republic of Congo. I had come back, it was late November, and I got back on a Saturday or Sunday, and I remember going into the office in a building that now doesn't exist anymore. It was a horrible little building, and my office was in the sub basement, so you were sort of 2 floors underground and felt like you were in a cave. I remember going in and checking for my mail and stuff. I'd been away for over 2 months, and I saw on the secretary's desk, I saw a cable about a request for assistance for an unknown disease in Nigeria, and I thought, I wonder what that is and how are we involved? So this was on a Sunday. On the Tuesday, I was told, could you please turn around and go to Nigeria, having been away in Zaire for at least two months. And on the Thursday, I left. It was an unknown epidemic, assumed or thought to be possibly yellow fever. I met up with an epidemiologist from Fort Collins, you know, from where the vector-borne disease group is based. They're the ones that look after, today called the Division of Vector-Borne Infectious Diseases. They're the ones who look after arboviruses and vector-borne, other non-parasitic vector-borne infectious diseases. So I met up with him in Chicago at the airport. Sort of exciting, you know, people looking for you with plaques with your name on it and so on. And so we go off to Nigeria. We land in Nigeria and meet with WHO and the Ministry of Health. And the Ministry of Health, either they didn't know we were coming or they said they didn't know we were coming. And it was, we had to sort of hang around a bit waiting for permission to go to the field. And we eventually got that, split into teams. I was with I ended up on a small team of three or four other people. One of them was a Ugandan virologist who actually I knew. He worked for WHO, and I knew him because I'd known him in Kenya when I, you know, just from 3 or 4 years earlier. A young Nigerian called Nasidi, who was also a young virologist, and a public health advisor from CDC who was assigned to UNICEF and who was working for the expanded program on immunization. None of us had ever seen yellow fever. So the two or three teams split up. That was the team I was on. We drive to the east of Nigeria, to Igbo land, where, you know, the civil war had, the group that had seceded from the federal state. And the capital of the province was, district was Benue. We get to the field. We go to eventually where there was reports of disease activity. And now, this was before email, before cell phones. I mean, when you were out, you were out, you know, and nobody knew where you were and so on. So we were on our own in this pretty remote place and obviously had stumbled into a very, very bad situation. A local school, I mean, a really dingy facility, had been turned into a sort of sick room or a hospital. And we went in there and there, you know, 25, 30 people lying in bed, some of them with jaundice. There were some nearby. We were shown freshly dug graves, you know, people who died recently. The school had closed, and they'd had something like 7 deaths over a period of a few weeks, whereas the whole year before, there had only been 1 death in the whole school. So it's obvious there was a very bad situation going on. And, you know, we looked around the area, talked to people, and there was a one epidemiologist who working for the state I think he was Filipino, if I remember correctly. He had been sort of trying to figure out on his own what was going on and had done his best to describe what obviously was an outbreak. First question when you arrive in a situation like this, is there an epidemic? Second question, if there is an epidemic, is it due to what you think it is or what you're being told it is? Clearly there was, obviously there was an outbreak. Was this yellow fever? Well, we looked at patients and so on and came to the conclusion this really probably was, but there's no diagnostic testing had been done. But it was difficult to come up with any better explanation. So we, third step in such a situation, describe in time, place, and person. Draw an epidemic curve. Who's affected? Age, sex, etc. Where are they? So we got, you know, drew an epidemic curve on a piece of paper. And the first time I'd ever done this. I mean, you know, first time any of us had done this. And so clutching this piece of paper, we thought, this is impressive. You know, cases, deaths, obviously something very bad going on. And we then, you know, had internal discussion, thinking, well, this is obviously a disaster. This is yellow fever, and the only thing to do here is mass vaccination. We then thought, well, how do we do that? Well, the only people who have the logistics, who can assure the logistics to do this, is the military, because this was difficult terrain, big geographic areas. And Nigeria was pretty much a military state in those days. So we thought, well, all right, let's go and see the governor. We've got to go and see the governor. He's in charge. He commands the local military. Let's go and do this. Let's go and talk to him. So we go and talk to him with our epidemic curve, saying, you know, this is what's going on. We think this is what it is. We think you should, you know, instruct the military to conduct mass vaccination. Our UNICEF colleague, the CDC public health advisor, was experienced in, I mean, knew about vaccination programs and knew about yellow fever vaccine and injectors and all of that sort of stuff. So we thought we were on, you know, we had some technical capacity. Having done all that, we had agreed ahead of time to regroup and meet the rest of the different teams and so on. And we did that and eventually set up a base in the heavily affected area. And by this time, as we were getting back to our base, the CDC senior person, Tom Monath, Dr. Tom Monath from Colorado, who also just happened to be the world expert on yellow fever, he was there, and you know, we drove in and I introduced myself, and Jose Esparza was a WHO virologist. He also had been sent. So Tom and Jose were there. I introduced myself, and this I'll never forget. Tom says, "This is bad, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, it's very bad." And he says, "You know, I don't think this is yellow fever." So we spent, Jose will testify to this. Interestingly, I just saw him last week somewhere. We spent about 45 minutes debating what this was. And, you know, Tom Monath would say, well, it could be hepatitis. Now, Tom obviously knew infinitely more about yellow fever than I did, because I knew nothing. But I did know a lot about liver disease. And I knew, frankly, infinitely more about hepatitis and other things than he did. And we had a debate, and he would say, well, it could be this. And I said, no, it that just doesn't behave like that. And you know. So it was very, very, you know, obviously it was kind of gut-wrenching, but at the same time, intellectually fascinating. And you know, by the next day, when he sort of looked around a bit more, he said, yeah, this is yellow fever. And then he set up a small mobile lab. I have pictures of him in the kitchen of the house that we're living in, doing enzyme immunoassays on the kitchen table with stuff that he'd, portable equipment he had brought along. And sure enough, the tests for acute antibody, IgM antibody to yellow fever, were positive, and it was a yellow fever outbreak. And it was we worked together for 3 or 4 weeks. This working with Tom Monath in the field was just a most remarkable experience. I mean, real privilege. We were there for my total deployment was about a month. It included being there for Christmas. I remember leaving the area on Christmas Day, actually. At the end of our investigation, you know, we thought that in this local government area of about 200,000 people, there had probably been some 40,000 yellow fever infections, 20,000 cases with jaundice, and about 5,000 deaths. And you know, what was striking was that this went largely unreported in the international media. I mean, it really was you know, a faraway place with a terrible epidemic and nobody knew or nobody cared. There were many interesting side stories to all of this, but also what was medically important was that Monath, you know, was aware that he pointed out that with the Christmas coming up, there would likely be a lot of travel, and it was not inconceivable that yellow fever would spread to other parts of Nigeria. And sure, you know, I left late in December, I think, to go back to Atlanta. I then had an interesting, as an aside, I just had an interesting time because Tom said to me, well, come and work in the lab on all these specimens we've collected. So in January, February, I went out to late January, February to a very cold Colorado to work in the lab and do serology on these specimens. And that was, you know, useful experience and good to meet all these people. And but sure enough, in April, this was now my April of this was still my first year of EIS, actually. Sure enough, in April, we got reports of further possible yellow fever, but now somewhere else in western Nigeria, and in a town called Ogbomosho, disease activity in the city. And this was the first time there had been urban yellow fever in Africa in 40 years or so. So we went back, some of the same team went back for that, Monath, myself, Nasidi, now much more experienced in yellow fever. And again, it was just a remarkable experience working with Monath. Both these epidemics were then well described in the medical literature, and again, coming full circle, there is now an ongoing, as we speak today in June 2016, there's an ongoing, it's been going on for several months, quite very bad epidemic of yellow fever in Angola, which probably CDC would be a lot more involved in. We are involved, but we'd probably be a lot more involved if everybody was not involved in Zika in the Americas. But Monath, and one of the challenges right now is there's a global shortage of yellow fever vaccine. Although what's interesting about the vaccine is that this vaccine, which was introduced in the late 1930s, international health regulations are that you have to renew it every 10 years. Actually, it's probably effective lifelong, and probably the doses that are used are unnecessarily large, and we could actually dilute the vaccine and spread it further. There was a leading article in the Lancet, or an editorial on this in the Lancet, an opinion piece a few weeks ago by Monath and some other colleagues, and I was pleased to see that in the references cited were our couple of our, you know, papers in the literature from way back when in Nigeria. So again, a sort of full circle story.
Oh, that's pretty neat. I honestly, listening to this, want to stay in Nigeria for a long, long time, but with time constraints, yeah. I guess we can't. But yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. Let's skip ahead a few years to, there's several years to, I think in 2000, you become director of the CDC office in Kenya.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell me about that, taking that position and going back to Kenya?
The CDC had been working in Kenya since 1979. And the reason it first got involved was to initiate malaria research, particularly in the region around Lake Victoria, which is intensely malarious. And the CDC presence was really rather small. There were, I think, two or three direct hire staff doing malaria research, an epidemiologist, an entomologist, a public health advisor. And I went back for personal reasons as much as anything else, but scientific ones as well. I wanted to get back to fieldwork. So I was pleased to get back to fieldwork. I took the position of ostensibly the head of the malaria research station, but I was living in Nairobi. The research was mainly up by the lake. I traveled up regularly. But one of the requirements, really, I had negotiated it, but it was necessary for a number of reasons anyway, was that we had to get into HIV work. And my background by this time was predominantly HIV. Had to get into HIV work, firstly, because this area around Lake Victoria, the rates of HIV were very high. Prevalence in the adult population of 15-20%, sort of Southern Africa type levels of prevalence. And frankly, we hadn't gotten into it enough. There was a reticence to do it for a number of self-reinforcing reasons. There was a lot of stigma, a lot of discrimination. The population was resistant to the idea of HIV. Then there were concerns that HIV would cloud everything else going on and break working relationships if research in HIV was conducted, etc. So some low-level things were done, and there was work on blood safety and some public health assistance. But we had reached a conclusion that we really have to get serious about this. At the same time, at the end of the Clinton administration in the late 90s, there was an initiative called the Life Initiative, which was an early initiative to increase investment in global work on HIV, including and perhaps especially for the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And so we got programmatically involved in HIV work as well. With Life, we had to decide, well, what are the different HIV priorities? And we identified four or five, such as surveillance, voluntary counseling and testing, tuberculosis, the HIV in the military. And we got more programmatically and prevention. And we got more programmatically involved. So very quickly, it became somewhat of not only do we do malaria work, but we also were doing HIV stuff. And I think the most, my most useful intervention in the malaria work actually was to help the colleagues who were doing some fantastic work, just help them focus a bit and especially get what was going on finished. And what was going on was a very, very large trial of insecticide impregnated bed nets. And that was just a wonderful piece of work. A large cluster randomized trial of bed nets. I think I did play a useful role in just sort of helping them focus down on and pushing to get it finished and written up. One of the memories, and actually, there's a lesson here because I've seen it at different times. An area of work we don't invest in often enough is data management. I should come back to that with the Ebola discussion. There was this mass of data from the malaria studies going back years, and colleagues. I'm thinking particularly of a colleague called Feiko Tefkeuler, who was a Dutch malariologist, is now a professor of tropical medicine or whatever at the University of Liverpool. He's still involved with us in Kenya, actually. Excellent person. But I remember talking with him and his wife also, Penny Phillips Howard, was a researcher. And there was just this mass of data, and yet it was sort of like a mountain, but the gold is in the middle. And the rest is kind of, I sort of had to persuade if I could just sort of hack away at it and get to the... And it was an early example of cross-disciplinary collaboration, because actually one of our HIV colleagues, I got him to work with them on data management. And here we had, our HIV group working with the malaria people to assist with data management. To cut a long story short, that piece of malaria work was... a few years later published as a whole supplement to the American Journal of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, and is just a brilliant piece of work and conclusively showed that the regular use of bed nets resulted in something like a 20% 20 to 25% reduction in all-cause mortality in children, you know, a remarkable result.
Right.
So we grew the Kenya program very substantially between 2000 and 2006. We were very fortunate to have excellent collaboration and support from headquarters. Managed to, my previous job actually before I went to Kenya was I was director of the division of HIV prevention, surveillance and epidemiology, and managed my deputy who succeeded me. We stayed in touch. He gave us good support, and we were able to expand, including some very substantial infrastructure expansion, like buildings. And then, of course, history changed with President Bush's announcement in 2003 about PEPFAR, and later the President's Malaria Initiative, PMI, and in 2004, another infectious disease program, the Global Emerging Infections Program, was allocated to Kenya. So we developed a field epidemiology training program. So different components expanded, fell into place, and have resulted in what's today a very, very large platform.
Right. So if we were to say kind of briefly where you went from, I think it was 06 on, after that you go to Geneva, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Okay.
I was asked... I'd been in Kenya six years, and you know, one shouldn't stay in these places forever, and there are rules about this. And so I was casting around for what else to do, and I was actually invited to become the director of WHO's HIV program, the Department of HIV in Geneva, which is the global program of WHO for HIV. And I was in Geneva from 2006 to the middle of 2009.
The middle of 2009.
3.5 years.
Right. And then where do you go from there?
Well, I went back to Kenya for a short while before coming back to Atlanta as the founding director of the Center for Global Health.
Right. And then where?
Well, I was in... again, for family reasons, my children actually were in Kenya, and it was they needed my attention, and I just had to make the human decision that I have to go back to be with them.
How old are they?
Now they're bigger. They were still they were in they're now 21 and 18, so it's a few years ago, and they were 16, 17, and a bit younger.
Spend some more time with family.
Yeah, they. But anyway, that's sort of an irrelevance. But I went back to the field in at the end of 2012.
Mm-hmm. So where were you exactly when you started hearing about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa?
Well, it was interesting. I was in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Kenya. It was 2014. So I'd been back in Kenya just about 14 months or so. 15 months. My the person, Joel Montgomery, Dr. Joel Montgomery, was the head of the infectious disease work, the Emerging Infections Program. We organized ourselves in an organizational structure where I created an umbrella just referred to it as health security, and under it we had a series of different programs, including refugee health and the laboratory, and human-animal health, One Health, emergency preparedness, etc. But anyway, Joel looked after that area of work. And in March of 2014, I think it was the 20th of March or so, WHO for the first time reported cases from Guinea, and about 10 days later from Liberia. And Joel was asked by headquarters to go to Liberia for a TDY, and went for there were cases of Ebola up in Lofa County, which is on the borders of the three countries come together, the forest area of Guinea and Gwekedu, Liberia, Lofa County. And He went in early April or so. He only went for about 2.5 weeks. It appeared that things were relatively under It appeared that things were, you know, under control. That it was, you know, no reason to stay, and he was able to come back to Kenya. And you know, one read the reports, the infectious disease update, the outbreak updates that come out of CDC or the reports elsewhere from WHO and so on, and it seemed to me that, you know, this is big. I mean, this is a lot of cases, not in Liberia at that time, but in, you were hearing about further cases in Guinea, in the capital city. Then there were cases in May. There were cases in Sierra Leone, and I thought, you know, this, what's going on? What are people doing? I mean, this is just not anybody in particular, just the world. You know, this seemed like a significant event. I happened to be coming back to CDC for meetings and other meetings in late June. And was eager to talk to different people, I mean, including in my own center, the center of which until a while before I'd been the director. And I asked questions saying, how involved are we? What's going on? Are is the Emergency Operations Center activated? This was now late June, drifting into early July. And I spoke to a number of people and actually sent a couple of emails to fairly senior people saying, just what's going on? And I was then asked by, I'm going to have to check on the name, by a senior colleague. She reached out and said, look, do you want to go to Liberia? Because they had just received CDC had just received via the embassy in Monrovia, a specific request for epidemiologic assistance. So here I am in early July, CDC asking do you want to go to Liberia? Can you go? And I thought, well, really, yes, I should. I mean, we have to do this. And talk to some old colleagues or people, people I knew or knew the name of in special pathogens, and you know, not an Ebola expert. I mean, I'd done my EIS in this group, but I knew something about all these infections, but I certainly not an expert of the level of colleagues in special pathogens. And I agreed to go. And I remember I went on the 16th of July. Happened to remember the date because it was my happens to be my sister's birthday. And I had talked to the person heading the response. She was on holiday, but I remember having a long conversation with her by phone as she was driving across the other side of the country. I went on the 16th of July, and we were a very small team. I flew from, I'd gone back to Kenya, so I flew to Monrovia from Kenya. The team in total comprised, I think we were seven. There was myself, four EIS officers, a colleague who had just finished EIS in special pathogens, and another colleague who'd finished EIS a couple of years earlier, Satish Pillay. So Satish was the senior person, apart from myself. We all got there approximately around the same time. Again, back to basics, you know, is there an epidemic? If there is it due to what you think it is? And then can you, describe it in time, place, and person? And again, it made me think of that yellow fever experience, in that you just look around Monrovia and it was clear there was a major, major problem. There was only one Ebola treatment unit in the grounds of a hospital called ELWA, Eternal Love.
Winning Africa.
Winning Africa.
Right.
They had a very small unit and they were expanding it. And when I say they, these were staff of Samaritan's Purse, which is a faith-based organization. A rather conservative, politically conservative, faith-based organization. It had been founded by Billy Graham's son. Very well connected politically in Washington. Went to see them, met the doctor, his name was Kent Brantley. Met him, I was very impressed with what they were doing. They said they were not hemorrhagic fever experts, but they had seen the need and had talked with MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, who really are, who have worked on many outbreaks and really are experts. And MSF had agreed to work with Samaritan's Purse, train them, had trained them, and had sort of signed off that they were, fit to go. And I was impressed with what Samaritan's Purse were trying to do. MSF were terribly stretched. There are now two treatment units in Liberia, one in Monrovia and one up in Lofa County. MSF was in all three countries and just stretched to the limit. And so we're very happy to hand it over to SP, Samaritan's Purse. Other things we did early on were there were no data. The data were all over the place. The case counts. We started asking, well, how do we know where these case counts are coming from? And this goes back to my comment that I think we severely underinvested in data management from the beginning. That was compounded by a problem that there was a rather clever database that was based on the CDC developed EpiInfo application, EpiInfo is a database that, or a package that CDC developed many years ago, has gone through different versions, can do data management analyses, outputs of reports and so on, tabulating, graphing and so on. And a modification had been made of this specifically for hemorrhagic fever outbreaks. It was a difficult tool to use, and it was just dwarfed by, the magnitude of the problem here, and had some technical constraints. But there was a real desire to use it, and understandably. But we spent a lot of time in the beginning trying to figure out where are the data coming from, because you have all these reports of cases, but in fact, data were coming into the ministry by cell phone, by paper report. Lab tests were coming in. There were reports of dead people, ambulance calls, of cases in the community. So it was a chaotic data situation. It took us a while to figure out, to piece out, how all this was coming from, and trying to assess whether this could be put in some sort of credible description. We didn't do lab work directly, but one of the first things the minister asked me to do, and actually it was in that original letter of assistance, was to assist with the lab. Now, there was one laboratory in what was an institute called the Liberia Institute for Biomedical Research, LIBER, which was outside of 50 kilometers or so outside of Monrovia near the airport, went out there to see what was going on. And there was some very commendable work being done by an NIH colleague and folks from the U.S. Army Medical Research Infectious Disease Institute, USAMRID. And it was almost, I never quite understood how they were there or how they got there. They had a long-term engagement for hemorrhagic fever research, but they were the only show. They were there and they were training Liberian technicians and so on. But it was so the assistance we provided, although it wasn't at that time direct technical assistance, and it wasn't CDC staff doing the lab work. Nonetheless, we were able to broker a lot of the relationships that were needed to start getting results to the right places and making sure they were going to, that somebody was going to replace critical staff when they left the country and stuff like that. So we did play a useful role, obviously always talking with headquarters and so on. But it was a dire situation, and those first couple of weeks were stressful and troubling, adrenaline driven. The situation was terrible. The patients were coming to the hospital, lying in hospital grounds, trying to get admitted to the ETU, which didn't have any beds. Shortage of staff, people dying in their houses, reports of bodies not being collected for several days. A number of people, dead bodies in the streets. And later, jumping ahead a little bit, but later, a very unpleasant occurrence, which led to a unique event, which was an order by the president, a decree that dead bodies be cremated in Monrovia. What had happened is that the water table in Monrovia is very high, and somewhere a number of bodies had been buried, but with intense rain just floated up. And so these bodies just floated up, obviously causing distress and outrage. And the order to go to cremation is a remarkable thing, actually, because it's extremely against the local culture. And actually was one of the things that was hated the most, but was probably necessary. It was enforced for a few months and then was able to be lifted. But again, just going back to the beginning, so we, having arrived on the 16th, a number of events happened in the first couple of weeks which were extraordinary in themselves and really changed global perceptions of Ebola in a way that was remarkable. On the 20th of July, I think that was the date, around that time, a senior person, well connected to high levels of government, traveled from Monrovia to Lagos by airplane, with a stopover in Togo. Visibly ill when he got on the plane, collapsed on his arrival in Nigeria. Was immediately hospitalized. The correct diagnosis was made by the attending physician of suspected Ebola, which is what he had. He died. The physician got infected and died. And there were, a number of secondary and tertiary infections, I think 19 in total, if I recall. I would have to check that. That whole event described separately in Nigeria, I won't go into it. They did contain it. Many lessons from that experience in Nigeria. But this was really everybody's nightmare, that somebody gets on an aeroplane from one of the heavily affected countries, ends up the other side of the world, causes, or elsewhere in Africa, sets up a secondary epidemic somewhere else. Absolute nightmare. And of course, nothing new about this concept. I mean, the whole concept of emerging infectious disease is always said, with air travel and so on and so forth. But here you actually had it happen with Ebola for the first time. The second thing that happened very soon afterwards was that I was asked by my Samaritan's Purse colleagues, could we chase up some lab results? They gave me a name. So we did. Took a while because the names didn't quite match with... Long story short, this was not just some specimen. This was from Kent Brantley, the Samaritan's Purse physician, who, if I remember the days correctly, on a Tuesday had woken up feeling unwell and with a fever, had isolated himself. And I think this specimen was from the Thursday, and we were trying to find the result on a Saturday, and it was over the weekend that we communicated to Samaritan's Purse that the specimen was positive. And we learned that actually this is not just some, you know, that it's not whatever name it was given, it was actually the physician. So we got into intense discussions with Samaritan's Purse, and obviously quickly had to mount an investigation as best we could of what had gone on, what happened here. Samaritan's Purse then, a short while later, had a second infection in Nancy Whittable, who was a nurse. She also was infected. We then learned that actually they had a third infection in a Liberian hygienist who had actually died. So we had to investigate that whole situation and also communicate, discuss with them, and we were involved in, again, totally new issues such as access to experimental medicines. Because I said to the Samaritan's Purse people, and I said, you know, CDC doesn't do this. We're not providing treatment or care. You've got a senior researcher here who's actually, you know, does Ebola therapeutic studies for a living. Maybe you should talk about all of this. Kent Brantley did end up getting the medicine ZMAP, actually. Now, this totally uncharted territory, because you've got this raging epidemic. What do you do with expatriates who are infected, and who gets this very scarce product and who doesn't? As a matter of interest, later on, again, got involved in calls between our director and Liberia, because the Liberian president, Johnson Sirleaf, had written to President Obama asking for medicine, ZMAP, for infected medical staff, Liberian medical staff. Again, these totally unprecedented sort of situations. Again, never addressed before, is what do you do with expatriate healthcare workers infected? In the old days, the sort of, understanding was you're on your own. This was not going to be possible in this huge outbreak with, you know, but I think very relevant also is that Kent Brantley worked for Samaritan's Purse, and Samaritan's Purse are very, very highly connected. So we had, for the first time ever, we saw the medical evacuation from Africa to the United States of people with Ebola infection. Both of them survived, as you know. So this is all playing out over the first 10, 14 days or so. Another thing that happened in the first week was one of the most useful things we did was, you know, sometimes you sort of look at situations and there are key decision moments where you have insight, or hopefully have it right, and you say, this needs to be done. And one of the first things we did was, when we arrived, myself, these EIS officers and so on, was to go to the ministry and go to the daily meeting of the so-called Ebola Task Force. Well, the Ebola Task Force was an open meeting in a big conference room in the, you know, in the ministry, not very, sort of fairly, not exactly a privileged building. Apparently open meeting, I mean, there were 70, 80 people there, and sometimes very senior people would show up. The president sometimes came. And the discussion, there was an agenda, the discussion would happen, but anybody could talk. Went on for a couple of hours. Decisions, I mean, suggestions were made. But then the next day, it would sort of be a repeat of the day before. You know, it wasn't quite clear what was being followed up on. And, you know, the the sequencing of all of this was not very clear. And I said to my colleague Satish, I said, this doesn't work. We need a structure here. And we talked about an incident management system analogous to how our CDC Emergency Operations Center works. Now, again, neither of us were expert in this, but we, you know, quickly consulted some documents and talked to folks at headquarters, and went back to the, wrote up a little suggestion to go to the minister and say, look, we think you need to do this. And you know, what we advised was restrict these meetings, you know, to very small size, appoint an incident manager, have key people reporting to him for priority areas like, you know, surveillance and case management and laboratory and so on and so forth. Very, you know, hierarchical, well-defined system, daily meetings with notes taken, action points which get reported on within 24 hours and so on and so forth. And I remember it was on a Wednesday, I think. We go to the ministry. I think this was about a week after. This was now, I think, 7 days after my arrival in country and having done a lot of work on trying to figure out where the data are coming from in the lab, and having witnessed the guy going to Nigeria. We go into the minister's office, Satish and myself, sit down. I start speaking, and literally my first sentence, not finished, the secretary comes in and says, we have to evacuate the building, there's a fire. The minister gets up, the minister's a 75, 77-year-old surgeon. He was very good, Ganiwande, and was his name. He goes over to his computer, goes over to the window. I start hearing more and more noise from down below. This is several floors up. And I say, Minister, can we accompany you out? We need to go. Yeah, I'm coming. I said to Satish, we need to go. We head down the stairs, this thick smoke. Start coughing, and I think, this is actually, got to get out of here. This is not good. Get out of the building. Get all the CDC, there's now hundreds of people in the car park. Get all the CDC people together, get our vehicles and leave. And I find out later what likely happened was that it was probably a family member of a person with Ebola who died. That's what I heard. Had actually gone into the conference room, piled all the chairs together, poured kerosene over them, and tried to set the building on fire. So this is all sort of week one. You can see this was a very, very odd experience. And, you know, I kept saying to our EIS officers, look, this is unusual. We split up into, you know, people doing different things. One person went to the hospitals to get better insight into hospital hygiene and infections in healthcare workers. I sent one EIS officer to other parts of the country to try and rapidly establish, you know, there's 15 counties in Liberia, rapidly establish where, in places we had not heard of cases, was there any activity suggestive that there was a disease transmission going on. So he covered thousands of kilometers in very difficult, very, very difficult terrain. Did a very good job. The EIS officers were really splendid. I can give you names of all these people, but I have to look them up. So the political ante in Monrovia just rose and rose to the end of the month. Not enough beds, a dire situation in Lofa County. Not enough beds in Monrovia. This problem with, you know, the burials. I mean, just everything dysfunctional, and the extent of the outbreak unclear. By this time, there had been hundreds of cases, according to the data that we had. I mean, we had over, by this time, five, by the end of the month, I think over 500 cases. all sorts of things happening at the same time. The WHO rep pulled out, changed. A new structure called UNMEER created, which by the Director General, by the Secretary General of the United Nations, which I guess expressed A, that he wanted to be more in control and have information, and B, that he didn't have confidence in what WHO was doing. You know, interactions with the embassy, advising the ambassador, who then early in August declared an emergency, before WHO, actually, I think, if I recall. Just lots of different things at the same time. Sent one of our EIS officers up to Lofa County. Very hot up there. There was concern. There was a lot of there was some resistance, and vehicles were, Samaritan's Purse vehicles were being stoned. And actually, he had to escape across the border, crossing, I think, by canoe into Guinea. You know, no passports or anything. I mean, this was just very, very unusual stuff. I ended up leaving in mid-August. Oh, another thing that happened, which was, I mean, sort of in retrospect humorous, but at the time concerning, the EIS officer who'd gone to Almia, was her name, she'd gone to hospitals. One day she comes in and says she doesn't feel well. And I said, what's the matter? She says, well, she's got diarrhea. And I say, okay. Then another one says, yeah, I don't feel well either. I said, do you have fever? No. Where have you been? Well, I've been to the hospital. What did you do? Well, I shook hands with a physician. Was he well? Seemed to be. Did you touch any patients? No. Okay, it's, you know, you tell yourself this is not Ebola. And yet, when you lie awake at night, you know, you think, you know, next day, are you any better? Well, no, not really. You start saying, I wish these women would just get better. You know, you tell yourself this is not Ebola. This is, of course, this is not possible. And actually, it didn't make any sense because they were sharing a little apartment in the hotel, and both of them were sick, and the incubation periods wouldn't be right, and whatever. But you obviously it caused concern. But I know they got better. But there were just many, many events. It was one of the most intense experiences of my life. By the time I left in mid-August, I mean, we had conveyed to headquarters that this was a disaster and this was a very, very bad situation. And I think, you know, we're able to convey sensible advice about laboratory need and, need for data management and what kind of assistance was required. And so I was replaced. Tom Frieden, the CDC director, came in late August. And actually, what was interesting also, I remember this very well, it is just so difficult in that situation to sit at the end of a telephone and try and describe to people the other side of the world what it's really like. And, you know, the magnitude of this epidemic is totally unprecedented. We've never seen Ebola in capital cities. It was difficult just to describe the difficult conditions of Monrovia with the rains and, you know, the Ebola treatment unit that was bursting to capacity, or twice as many patients as could be accounted for, dead people inside who weren't being collected, and the stress that our MSF colleagues were under. Samaritan's Purse pulled all their personnel out. That was, you know, without really talking to anybody, they just did it. To convey all of this and the unusual atmosphere and it was very difficult. And there were people back here who, I think, not that they didn't believe it, I think they questioned whether we were staying objective or not. And perhaps were we getting stressed and were we exaggerating? And The answer is no, we were not. Was it stressful? Yes, it was. Were we objective? Yes, we were. Did we get it right? Yes, we did. And actually, when Dr. Frieden came at the end of, I think he came the end of August, I think he visited all three countries very quickly. I talked to him later before my second deployment, and I'll come back to that. He asked to speak to me, and he said, before our conversation started, he said, I just want to tell you, you know, I realized when I went in August, he said, you were right. And I was very, obviously, you know, it was reassuring or, what's the word? It was good to hear him say that.
Right. Confirmation.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we did have it right. When he got back, I remember him telling me or hearing from others, when he got back, in, which I think must have been early September, within hours of arrival, he was on the phone to the White House talking with the president. And the president came to, President Obama was here in CDC mid-September, which is when he announced the deployment of 3,000 troops to Liberia, as well as all sorts of other, assistance. So this was just a absolutely remarkable experience. I always emphasize to my colleagues, especially, and I did it to the EIS officers, that it's important to write, to document stuff. And it's not so you get more papers on your CV or, I mean, all those things are important, but if you don't document it, nobody will ever know you were there. And some of these events are so important, they must, and it's, you know, it's an obligation, and it's an obligation to the people that you're doing things to or about. So we did actually write up a paper in the Emerging Infectious Diseases describing that early experience in Liberia, which, I don't think this is going to be, you know, the greatest science, but it's an important, I personally felt it remarkably important to be able to document it. And I hope my younger colleagues did too. And I reread that paper, I think, yeah, we did do the right stuff. And with the, it's a good example of how bad data, limited data, you know, information that isn't necessarily perfect, but it's good enough. It's good enough to draw important public health conclusions, which is what we did. And what that first experience, that first deployment actually captured was how Ebola had gone from an obscure African infection that caused some, you know, outbreaks once in a while that in a remote part of the world suddenly becomes a priority for global health security and is actually being discussed, you know, at the very highest political levels. It was, you know, discussed on the floor of the United Nations, discussed by the Security Council. Really quite remarkable.
Dr. Nasidi, you mentioned you spent time within Nigeria doing the yellow fever. Is he the same Dr. Nasidi who then initially ran the response in Nigeria?
Probably, yeah. I'm sure.
Okay, gotcha. And did you have like a formal position title when you were in Liberia for that first deployment? Were you CDC lead or something like that?
Team lead.
I mean,
was that an official title?
Yeah, sure.
I was the team lead.
Gotcha.
I eventually had three deployments. Right. And I was team lead each time. I went back. Should I just keep?
You know, yeah, please do.
I went back again. I went back in November 2014, early November. Completely different situation. A lot of work had been done between August and November. The CDC team now, from the initial seven, these CDC teams were now 60, 70 people. I think our team was about 60. And I was again team lead. It was an extraordinary privilege to do that. I mean, it really was. But we now, you know, managing 60 people is different from managing seven, and that the situation was completely different. Fascinatingly, Whereas before, the epicenter was Lofer County, which in July, August, Lofer County was 50% of the cases, Monrovia 25 to 30, and individual counties the rest. Now, Monrovia seemed to be the epicenter. Lofer was finished, actually. They didn't seem to have more cases. But you, and you still, what now, what the hypothesis now was, well, what we saw and thought, how do we put this together? Was that Monrovia was the epicenter and was sort of seeding different parts of the country by infected travelers, sometimes to very, very remote places. The story we had put together, which I think was, I think what I, and what I've just said is correct. And the story we put together back in July, August was Lofer County was the epicenter, had infected Monrovia, and then there were just isolated cases or clusters, usually often related to healthcare seeking in some other counties. So by the time, it was completely different by the time I was back there in November. Very important work had been done by different groups, the Red Cross and another NGO, picking up dead bodies and just assuring burials. Cremation was still enforced. There were still unsafe burials going on, but you know, things were better. And also, MSF had opened, and others actually, had opened a number of treatment units. And just getting those treatment beds there and getting patients isolated, really the incidence just dropped precipitously. So now we, you know, here I was now with a team of 60, and it was the, I think one of the reasons I feel so privileged is that I saw the beginning, the middle, and later my third deployment, the end of this epidemic. So in November through to up to almost Christmas, we, you know, excellent work was done by CDC staff dealing with these remote clusters, and the more experience we had, the quicker they were extinguished, with very rapid response, isolation of patients, and judicious use of quarantine, and also just making sure that even if when people are in very difficult geographic situations, that even moving them closer to an Ebola treatment unit and holding them, just in case anybody got sick, they could be isolated immediately. I had an interesting experience. I went to, I was asked to go to Sierra Leone. Cases in Liberia were getting fewer. You know, incidents clearly had dropped. There are now very few cases, but they would be in different places and about half in Monrovia, half elsewhere. But they're greatly reduced in number. In Sierra Leone, the epidemic was still very bad and seemed to be increasing. Essentially, what happened in Monrovia happened in Freetown as well, but later. So in early December, I was asked to go to Sierra Leone to, I think the embassy had, the American embassy in Freetown had arranged this, but to talk to the government, because they were asking what's happening in Liberia, why are they doing apparently well, and what's the difference? And you know, there was no magic answer. There's no magic bullet. But what did seem to me, I mean, how do we address Ebola? You isolate the sick, you safely bury the dead, and then contact tracing, which is, you know, following the contacts of cases or people who've died, is just to keep them under observation so that you can very quickly isolate somebody again if they get sick. So it's all about isolation. And the quicker you do it, when we have data now, you talked to my colleague Kim Lindblad earlier. She's written some stuff about some analyses on this, that we have very good data that the quicker you isolate people, you know, the less secondary transmission, the smaller the clusters and so on. And when I went to Freetown, it seemed to me that my impression was that there was a lot of discussion going on about we haven't got enough Ebola treatment units and we're furiously building capacity and so on. And the focus was on that rather than, that's fine, but isolate people immediately, and you do it with what you got. You do the best you can under, but get the patients isolated, and you may not have ideal Ebola treatment unit, but isolate them where you can and do it. And I think that was, I think that was a difference, and one of the reasons that it was lagging behind. It was, again, these unusual circumstances you get thrown into. How often do you talk to heads of state? Talked repeatedly to the head of state in Liberia, and in this visit to Sierra Leone, met the head of state. I was rather disappointed in that my fourth deployment a few weeks ago was to Guinea for a short while, and I thought, I wonder if I meet the Guinean president. I did not. I was very disappointed. Another very important insight, actually, was in Liberia, was that by the time now cases were much fewer, it was possible to be much more certain about data, and we had many more people, and some very, very, you know, CDC just had wonderful people on the ground. So there was much more human capacity to really figure it all out. But one lesson that I learned was, in all of this, the most reliable data actually came from the lab, because one positive test for Ebola, I mean, that shouldn't happen. That's a case. So actually, you know, although at the beginning we didn't really have a good insight into what proportion of patients are even being tested, and is there duplicate testing going on, and it was chaotic. But by now in November, it was possible to be absolutely certain, okay, the cases are being tested, and these are the positives, and these are the cases. And an epidemic curve now made some kind of sense. So that was an insight. If anything like this happened again, the laboratory is a very, very important source. Even if incomplete, it's a very, very specific source of data. The best descriptive data about who actually the case is, who is getting sick, those have to come from the Ebola treatment units. So we were there for 6 weeks, and it may have been Kim, actually. Somebody made a remarkable, it summarized what we were saying. As Monrovia goes, so goes Liberia, because Monrovia was seeding the rest of the country. And somebody else chimed in, and it was absolutely correct, because we've been talking about that as well. Whoever it was said yes, and as Guinea goes, so goes the region. And it turns out to be true, actually, because Guinea, it all started in Guinea, and I think Guinea was, has had the last infections as well. So that was a useful deployment. I was there for 6 weeks that time.
Do you remember, you said you came in November, is that right?
Yeah, early November.
Early November, and then departed when?
Just before Christmas.
Just before Christmas, yeah. Right. And then when do you make your third deployment?
That was in early March. Mm-hmm. I was asked to go back again. By now, totally different ball game. There were no cases. The last cluster had just finished. That last cluster, a bizarre series of occurrences. An urban cluster, very difficult social circumstances, substance use, criminality. People had to be tracing the contacts who ended up being referred to as VIPs. A very difficult series of circumstances and conditions, but successfully managed. No more cases, and we were asked, I was with my colleague Athalia Christie, she may be worth talking to actually, Athalia would definitely be worth talking to. We were again asked to go to over to Sierra Leone to talk to our colleagues there, which we did. And we were there for a couple of days, and lo and behold, we get a phone call from Monrovia, there's another case. We go back, and the the team is trying to take this unfortunate woman's life apart, this one case, no evidence at all of where this woman got infected from. I mean, you'd say, we knew that with no cases, we asked two questions. How would we recognize resurgent Ebola? And, you know, where would it come from? Well, the likeliest where it would come from would be presumably importation from another country, like, you know, from Sierra Leone, from Guinea. Or there's transmission going on we don't know about. And, we just could not find evidence of either of those explanations. However, this woman had a sex partner who was an Ebola survivor. And but what was unusual was that his illness had been more than 6 months before. It was September or so the year before. And we knew that there had been isolated reports of virus persisting in semen, but not this long. And the general recommendations were for abstinence or condom use for 3 months, and that was safe, and that was the end of it. And here was a man who, may have been a source. So we worked with others, with WHO colleagues and so on trying to work this out. Got a semen specimen, which actually was positive on PCR, on polymerase chain reaction, 199 days or so after his illness onset. And the genetic material in the two cases, in the survivor and the case patient, was genetically sequenced and essentially identical, with some identical mutations. So this was, very strong evidence that here we've got sexual transmission a long time after somebody recovered from Ebola. He's obviously been harboring virus. That was the dominant feature of that particular deployment, because we nailed that down, rapid MMWR, global advice with WHO and CDC changed on a dime because of this. So that was, just remarkable experience. We now know that since then there have been several other clusters initiated by survivors, either reactivating their disease, such as the case of the well-known case of the Scottish nurse who didn't transmit to anybody else, but she got sick with meningitis 9 months after her initial recovery, and had virus in her CSF and in her blood. So that was, very instructive. And there have been other clusters, including a recent one in Guinea, which initiated by sexual transmission. So there's an awful lot that's been learned about this, about this infection that we didn't know before. Just a most unusual story.
No doubt. Ian, you mentioned you went on a fourth deployment to Guinea recently.
I was asked to go to Guinea in April. These other events were in 2014. This is now 2015. But the last deployment was in 2015 to Liberia. So now this is 2016 April. There was a cluster in Guinea, which again illustrates what this can do. A case of sexual transmission infecting another person, some other infections, and then a woman with Ebola traveling to Monrovia with two of her children. The woman died in Monrovia. The two children were infected. They survived. This cluster seems to be finished now. So I was asked to go just... it wasn't quite clear what was going on, whether there was more assistance needed, etc. I was there for 10 days, and I came back soon afterwards, because other CDC colleagues, Michael Kinzer was the team lead, well, you know, well in charge of what was going on, and everything seemed to be under control, and there was no virtue in my staying.
Sure.
But it was interesting to see Guinea, a very different country from these three countries are so different, and totally different histories and organizations and so on.
Some of the people you've mentioned, like Dr. Joel Montgomery, I've had in here talking with him. Who are some of the CDC staff who really stand out to you from your multiple deployments you worked with? Can you describe some of them?
I'm going to have to get my notes out with names. Frank Mahoney has done very good work. You should talk to Frank.
I actually just did.
Yeah, okay.
It was great.
Frank is a real field person and very practical and action-oriented.
What did your work with Frank entail?
Well, I succeeded him. I was there, if you go back to 2014, so I was there July, August. Joel came back. I think Frank came in a bit later. Then I succeeded Frank. And I think I did that twice, actually. I've known Frank. I bumped into Frank in other places. Frank, obviously, is very, very seasoned. Athalia Christie was very good in the field. Kim Lindblad, just outstanding in
Absolutely.
The field.
Continuing with Frank just a second. Did you overlap a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit? Yeah. So was that kind of a time when you could share impressions and kind
yeah,
of get
I
an
mean,
update
it,
on
yeah,
what was
it
going
was,
on?
And one thing that impresses me about CDC is when CDC works well, people are very collaborative and collegial, and I might be senior to you today, and tomorrow you might be senior to me, and that's just the way it goes, and people move around and so on. So, there's no sense of ownership. We're sort of in these formal meetings at the ministry with all the international partners and WHO and so on, CDC has a seat at the table, and the senior person sits at the table. So, when Frank was the team lead and I was just coming in to take over, but he was there for another week or so, I sit behind, and when he's gone, I sit at the table, and that's fine. That's just how it goes. If you're interested, there were two papers that we did write. I mean, there's a bunch of MMWRs and so on. But for me, there were two papers we did write, which I felt very, very important, at least for myself, and to make sense of what this all meant. One was the early one, describing Liberia at the beginning, and then at the end, a summary of the whole thing. It may be worth your actually...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could send them to you.
That would be beautiful.
And they also have some. I could then give you the names of people that I really want to, highlight.
Oh, sure.
Satish Pillay. I mean, the first deployment. I mean, there are only seven of us. Every person did great. I mean, they really were. Joe Forrester was an EIS officer. He was actually a surgeon. He was on a surgical residency, which he interrupted to come and do EIS, and he's now gone back to finish his surgical residency at Stanford. He was, just totally field adapted. You could send him anywhere. It did really well under difficult living conditions. Satish Pillay was very reliable, very good.
Right.
We mentioned Frank, mentioned Athalia.
Can I ask also some partners who you worked with, especially closely from WHO or from the ministry?
Yeah, sure. Before I do that, though, I think the thing about CDC was, when it works well, people really work together. And we just had loads of very good people from all kinds of backgrounds just doing their jobs, I mean, just... doing Terry Lowe did excellent work on data management and good diplomatically navigating. I mean, data is always sensitive and navigating everything. So Terry's worth mentioning, and there's others, but just people working out in the forest, in difficult circumstances, living in tents sometimes. somebody, Jose, I can't remember his second name, had this fantastic transmission chain, which he'd done on PowerPoint, which he'd done in the forest. I mean, you know, I have it actually stuck on my, I have it stuck on my wall in Nairobi, just because it's so extraordinary. So just very, very good work indeed. Other people, we have to work with WHO. WHO obviously was very heavily criticized, and rightly so. I think this showed great weakness early on. They have done a lot to try and catch up, and we had excellent working relationships with the subsequent WHO representative.
Were there difficult moments early on in your experience with WHO that kind of stand out to you?
Oh, definitely there were. I mean, I think in Guinea particularly, but I wasn't there. I didn't, you know, this was early on in Guinea. I think there was definite territoriality. And when it wasn't in Liberia, it wasn't too bad. When I went in first time in July, it wasn't too bad. But there, it was a WHO old timer who was there, who definitely wanted to, you know, be in charge. I mean, be the senior public health person, and insisted on that. And he actually did have Ebola experience, because he dealt with outbreaks in the DRC, and was respected. But he was moved by WHO itself, and his successor was much more easy to work with. We worked together very closely, actually, Alex Gasasira. And we knew Alex because of other collaborations in immunizations and so on. I had one advantage in that, but I tell you, one strange experience, though. I think it was still Dr. Nestor was his name. I think it was still Nestor who was there. And the regional director, Dr. Samba, came through. Now, the WHO regional director, this is a big figure. I mean, WHORD, and in the WHO hierarchy, this is way up there. You know, there's only six of them, and they're sort of like barons of a medieval court. So he came through. Now, I knew him. Because I worked for WHO, I knew him. And, you know, I know the WHO system, and when I left WHO, the deputy director general at my going away function made a joke saying, you know, once WHO, always WHO. So I often use that line, you know, when I'm talking to them. And but I remember a very strange scene that just shows the difficulty of all of this. WHO was supposed to coordinate putting together a request to USAID, I think, for money to support the response. And I was asked to go and lend a hand, and passed by their office. And at 9 o'clock at night, there was the RD, the regional director, trying to put together a request for a response. And it wasn't going well. And, you know, I thought, this just shows there's nothing there. that's again, kind of unusual. We worked well with all organizations. MSF, I'm very impressed with. Again, person-to-person contact. The first coordinator who was there back in July, my first visit, she was just outstanding. MSF are good. Right. But the you know, heroic work being done by other civil society organizations, International Medical Corps, IMC, and others.
Right.
And I always felt, eventually, the U.S. Public Health Service did provide staff, because it was an ETU that was built by the troops in Monrovia, and that was going to be used for healthcare workers who got infected and so on. But the trouble is, for things that happened is the response inevitably lags behind the epidemic. What was very impressive epidemiologically was initially the exponential rise in cases. It was very dramatic. But it fell in the same way. The decline is exponential also. And inevitably, the response lags behind. So ETUs were being built as cases were declining. So yeah, there's a divergence in bed availability and numbers of new cases. And the machinery of international assistance is not easy to, you know, redirect. So that was kind of interesting. But I always felt eventually U.S. Public Health Service did provide clinicians, and there weren't any patients anymore, very, very few. And I always, as a physician myself, as a clinician by training, I always felt, you know, the folks who really put skin in the game are the ones who looked after the patients. Mm-hmm. What I did was, it was stressful sometimes, but it was the people who looked after the patients that, you know, I really take my hat off to. And I always felt slightly guilty, actually, that we weren't doing it. We did have CDC staff working in the lab and setting up a lab, and I felt very proud that they were doing that, including one of the things I also felt proud about was we had a lot of people from Kenya, from my office in Kenya coming. We had over 25 people who deployed in total, which I think was more than any other office outside of, you know, CDC headquarters.
Anyone in particular who you remember?
Who deployed?
Yeah, from Kenya.
Oh, sure. All of them. I mean, Barry Fields was a lab person, who, very good lab person. He's now here. Not a hemorrhagic fever person, but, you know, he deployed. They set up a lab. Clayton Onyango, one of our lab director in Kisumu, for our health security work, and others. I mean, just great work. And then some of our admin staff who have deployed, and they're, you know, local, our Kenyan staff. Some of our admin staff have gone to all of the three countries. IT people, all kinds of folks.
And did you say many of these are FETP grads?
No, these aren't. Okay. None of those were, because none of those were.
Okay.
But the there are FETP grads from other countries who've been, like the Congolese, for example, played an important role in Guinea.
Right. I want to ask, the task of setting up an entirely new system for dealing with the epidemic, a new incident management system, and bringing just that whole paradigm shift in sounds extremely difficult with the number of partners that you were dealing with and the number of other governments that were there. What was that like, communicating between so many different parties?
And it changed over time, of course.
Sure.
Because initially it was small.
Sure.
Although and what made me smile was that from the beginning, the tendency to always grow was impossible to overcome. So what eventually was called the incident management system, you know, which instead of meeting daily, by November, December was meeting three times a week or so. It was huge. But at the beginning, it was much smaller.
Beginning small.
But also what was done, and I think Frank Mahoney did this actually, and then we continued it, that CDC was trusted, and I and you know it health diplomacy, I mean, this is what it's about. It's getting people to trust you. And one of our weaknesses in the response, other than data management, if I had to say, what would you have done differently? Data management, I've talked about. I think lab capacity we should have expanded earlier. And the deployments should have been longer. I mean, everybody has day jobs, but we should have figured out a way that, especially senior people, would just be told, you're doing this for the next 3 months, you know, or whatever. Because you build up trust. You leave after a month, somebody else comes along. Obviously, people are different. They may have different ideas. I'm amazed that it went as well as it did, actually, despite that. So those are three important things I think I would have done different. The other thing is we didn't do very much and probably could have been handled differently is there was remarkably little research done during this whole event. So, for example, the trial of ZMapp, has been done, but it's underpowered. It's statistically so we actually don't. We have no proof that ZMapp works, and yet you've had 28,000 cases. So those are some observations. But what Frank did, which was useful, a smaller meeting was arranged, and I think he referred to this as the Gang of Six, if I recall. So it would be the incident manager and his deputy, and the CDC team lead and his or her deputy. And it was a very small group, and like an inner sanctum of the incident management system, and that was very useful and, of course, influential as well.
Okay. Can I just ask then, are there any other memories that you have that of conversations or, I don't know, vivid things that just pop up into your brain when you consider all of your deployments to West Africa?
No, things we didn't talk about in addition that,
right.
You know, to increase to the stress, the airlines stopped flying.
Yeah.
Monrovia started being, the American embassy evacuated. I mean, the non-essentials were sent home. When I was, the first time I was there, we talked about, advised about all of that. And so there was a real sense of that the place was being isolated. The events back here that contributed then to the way Ebola was looked at was what happened in September, I guess it was, when Thomas Duncan from Liberia flew while incubating his illness, arrives here, gets sick, Dallas Presbyterian, all of that. I mean, that brought the roof down. And, you know, I was back in Kenya when all that was happening, and I actually remember sending Tom Frieden a message just to say, look, because he had a hard time over all of that. And I sent him a message just saying, look, you know, we're with you. Sent him a quote from Theodore Roosevelt, I think, about, you know, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's you know, the critic, it's easy for the critic who, watches the great man stumble or whatever, but it's the person in the field with, you know, scars and blood. I mean, it's a bit dramatic, but it's a wonderful quote, actually. It's I can't remember it exactly. You see it on people's walls sometimes. He hadn't heard it before, and he said he appreciated it. What was sitting in Kenya, what was kind of interesting, thinking, I mean, I can understand why the events in Dallas were so, you know, so important, so attracted so much attention, fear, all the rest of it. But at the same time, one has to sort of think, you've got, you know, there's some of the best hospitals and laboratories in the country. You've got three or four cases, and we're out there struggling with thousands of cases and conditions most people here couldn't imagine. It is a little disproportionate, but that's the way the world works.
Okay.
No, it's a privileged experience. I mean, and actually what is so interesting, apart from this irony of EIS to, you know, no cases to this, it's unquestionably one of the most vivid medical professional experiences of my whole life, unquestionably.
Well, thank you again so much for your time and for the energy you've put into this. It's been a total privilege sitting in front of you and hearing. So thank you.
Good to meet you.